first off, let me just tell you just a teeny tiny bit about myself. My name is Teresa McBean. I serve as the executive director, the National Association for Christian Recovery. And I also co-pastor, along with my son, Scott McBean, who is our co-host, at a very humble, small recovery church called North Star Community in Richmond, Virginia. It's been in existence approaching 20 years. I've been co-pastoring with Scott for 4 or 5 years. I've lost track of the time because it's gone so fast and been so fun. But I feel like I live in two worlds, the petri dish of the actual work that we seek to resource and provide support for at the NACR. And so I feel like I'm really doubly blessed and have an awesome opportunity to keep learning all the time. And believe me, there's a lot I need to learn. So this webinar is part of a big dream that we've had to start and continue resourcing for the local community, because I know how much I need it as a local pastor and how limited our resources are, how hard it is to learn stuff and get to conferences and pay for classes. So at the NACR, we're always trying to leverage resources. Okay, so I hope all of you can see this quote by William Faulkner on the slide. To me, it is the epitome of what it means to participate either in recovery, as a person in recovery, a family member in recovery, certainly in terms of participating in a recovery ministry. It's like building a chicken coop in a high wind. You grab any board or shingle flying by or loose on the ground and you nail it down fast. And I think that is the best quote I've ever heard to describe what it's like to be brave enough, to be broken enough, to be willing to be part of a long-term, ongoing commitment to finding restoration as a result of the brokenness that substance use disorders create for us as families and communities and in churches. This work is not for sissies. I remember the first time I spoke to our senior pastor. We started in a large Southern Baptist church, our ministry originally as a Celebrate Recovery. And when we started in that sort of programmatical way, I went to the senior pastor and I said, I want to know what you are going to require to determine whether our ministry is a success or a failure. I'm kind of interested in knowing what our markers are for achieving so that we can sustain this thing. Because I think it, once you start it, as long as you have people there, it would be very hard to abandon them. And he was the wisest man, fantastic pastor and preacher. And he said, let's talk about that in 10 years. I think that's such wise words. It's just amazing. And most senior pastors may or may not have the wisdom to know that. But in recovery ministry, we have to think of a new way to have metrics for success if you're doing it within the body of the church, because this is a very challenging, long haul, and we've got to be gentle with ourselves and with the people we serve in terms of thinking about quote success. It's not even a word that enters my mind anymore. I've had that all trained out of me being in this field, specifically in recovery ministry, for almost 20 years. So that's my frame of reference in terms of thinking about what we're going to do. Here's some other stuff that we're going to do. We're going to talk about substance use disorders. Now, I want to call your attention to those three words, because this is the newest language when it comes to the field of addiction and alcoholism. The reason that people are trying to shift us to talk about substance use disorders, which I can't even say, much less remember half the time, are two really good reasons just to get us started. One, substance use disorder helps us think about this in a way that is a little less pejorative and possibly shaming. Two, it recognizes that substance use disorder is on a spectrum. And in recovery ministry or in our families, it's really important to understand this. So when you have somebody come to you as a pastor or a friend and says, hey, I just found out my 10th grader is smoking weed, that's a very different conversation than if somebody says, I have sent my kid to treatment 7 times and they're still using and they're 41 years old. There's a spectrum of this disorder, and we really have to understand that if we're going to be helpful and effective. The other thing that we're going to talk about is family systems and addiction. And sometimes I'm going to use the word addiction just because it's a word we're used to using. But I want to think about this in terms as a family system disease, a family system dysfunction, affliction, heartbreak, if you will. Because in the family system, everyone is affected, and we need to acknowledge that. For too long, we have said the person with the substance use disorder is the problem that needs solving. But if we get to the point where we have someone we love that we're in close relationship with who has a substance use disorder, we have already been affected. And this is true not just for families, but for churches. Any system that is in contact with someone with a substance use disorder becomes affected and often impaired because of the nature of the system. And we're going to talk about that a lot. You may need to remind me to talk about best practices for families and communities sometimes, because this changes so rapidly and sometimes I get distracted with describing the problem. But I do believe that there are some best practices that we can think about in terms of treatment and healing and restoration as it relates to substance use disorder. And we're going to talk about that. I think one of the things that I'll say every week is that what is a best practice now is going to be very different 3 years from now. So this is an ever-changing field. So if you love being a student, you love keeping current, this is not a bad place to be in this field of recovery ministry. The other thing that we're going to try to do is provide some undergirding principles that are helpful in treatment and recovery. And I think that sometimes if we miss these underlying principles, we can get off track really, really quickly. Let me give you an example. I had a family member recently say that their adult child, 21-ish kid, came to them after having been in treatment when they were 19 and had been going to meetings. And the adult child came to them and said, hey, I'm not going to go to meetings anymore. I'm spiritually at a place where I've decided that going to these meetings just reminds me of what my ism was. And I am a new creation in Christ, and I don't really want to go to meetings. I see there's some principles about managing the affliction of a substance use disorder that if that very, very devoted pastor, that's who is the parent of this child, will hear that message differently because they have the underlying principles. But if we don't have those principles, that may sound good, right? Like something to encourage. I hope that we're going to discover some reasons why that might not be a good thing, and that ongoing connection and management of the substance use disorder with tools that are broad and long and high reaching are going to be really important. And then I think we need to consider all these factors, how they impact how we treat substance use disorder, whether we're treating it within our family or whether we're treating it within our church or as an employer. I think it makes a difference. So that's what we're going to do in the next 6 weeks. Okay, so when we begin to think about some of the impact on family systems that a substance use disorder brings, here are a few very high levels that we're going to dive into in the next few weeks. Families are extremely resistant to change, and it is not because they're trying to be difficult or because they're defensive, although sometimes we do feel defensive as families when we're being asked to change. I want you to understand from my perspective and my experience that families are resistant to change because the addictive family system is set up to resist the change. This resistance is not personal. It's not even conscious. No family wakes up every morning and says, yay, Can we fix a system that is going to make it harder for our spouse, our parent, or our child to get out of their substance use disorder? No, everybody desperately wants to find solutions, but we are, as families, resistant to the solution. Now, what does this mean in terms of frustration over this resistance? I think we need to work to be very patient with each other and with the system and even with ourselves if we happen to be on the team that is trying to treat the substance use disordered family. Patience is a huge, huge deal. Here's the other thing, and I think it goes to this thing that I have about not measuring success. We need to take the long view. By that, I mean we need to set aside our judgments about what we think improvement looks like. This is super important for families. I'm hoping that I'll get Tom Banner to come on and teach a class on the stages of change at some point for substance use disorder. Just because we don't see something happening doesn't mean nothing is. In families where we are going to have to deal with substance use disorder, we are often pre-contemplating the problem. And then we go through a stage of contemplation. And what happens is we have a lot of stuff that has to take place before we can actually move to the action phase. This isn't because people are being difficult. It's because it's the nature of dealing with the family system. It's why I don't think short burst of programming work, but that long-term recovery ministries and treatment are essential. It is a marathon, not a sprint. I feel pretty certain about that, actually. Here's some things that we know about the addictive family system in general. It is very resilient, but not in a good way. It is passed on to the next generation before we even have a chance to address it. Let me stop there and expand on that point a little bit. You know, most of us at this point understand that if we did a genogram of our family or a family with a substance use disorder, what we would see is multi-generations of substance abusing. This is tricky to explain to the family because oftentimes the using part maybe has skipped a generation, but the system has not skipped its influence on the family. So what you might have is a second generation back substance use disorder, but the family, which I'm so set on us learning how it's affected by it, has been so affected that it creates a system that is very lacking in creativity and very rigid in its roles, which is why if you go into therapy or you go to a family group and they begin to describe the family system, you feel like they're talking about you, or maybe even they set up a video in your home. Even if you can't exactly identify with what they're saying, there's going to be an odd feeling of familiarity about what somebody's talking about. And that may be confusing to families because maybe the actual substance using was kept secret from the next generation of family. And they don't understand why there's a need for high achievement and performance, a lot of strictness and rigidity in the family roles and rules, why people might be a little, I don't know, over the top in some areas with rigidity about certain weird things. Like in my family system of origin, one of the things that popped up early for me that I noticed but didn't understand was this obsessive neatness about the way we keep our cars and our homes and our lawns. I came from a family that is doing a lot of appearance management. Do we have vocabulary for this? No. Do we know what's happening? No. Does this seem normal to us? Yes, because this is the only family we have. So we have multi-generations of ways of being in the world and in our family that seemed totally normal to us. One of the things that my therapist said to me early on when I was describing my family system of origin, she said, "Why do you smile or laugh when you tell these stories? There's nothing funny about this, Teresa. This is trauma." So what I've learned from my own experience is that this addictive family system is being passed down generationally. There's not vocabulary for it. Oftentimes, we begin to learn about it when we begin to see problems in our marriage or with our own children, and we've been practicing unhealthy ways of creating family, maybe hyper-spiritual, overly religious even. So I'm not talking necessarily about bad behavior. I'm talking about rigid behavior, behavior that lacks creativity. And it's a system that exists to sustain itself. I want you to hear this. The system is larger than the family, and it exists to thrive and sustain. I know that sounds mystical and mysterious and even creepy, and it is, but I want you to know that the system is there to keep itself going and breathing, and it'll take down anybody in the family it needs to in order for that to happen. I'm going to tell you a personal story in a minute about that. The other thing is that the addictive family system lacks the creativity to think of choices that are going to be helpful or creative or good. We tend to have all or nothing thinking. We're not very good about asking for help. We're very good at keeping secrets. We're very limited in our resourcing because we have had so much shame and guilt and just dysfunction that we're not used to creatively looking for solutions. And the system itself feels as if there are no good choices because we're what did Albert Einstein say? We can't solve a problem with the same thinking that got us into the problem. And that happens in addictive family systems down through the generations. Previous generations will encourage the current generation to maintain the same lack of creativity, rules-oriented rigidity, secret-keeping that has gone before them. Is it because they're jerks? Nope. It's because it's the system. One of the things that happens all the time in our recovery ministry is we will make a suggestion for somebody to go to a support group or attend a meeting, and they will always come back and they will say, "I am not like those people." So one of the things that's going to make it hard for all of us to find solutions and expand our influence in terms of restoring this very broken system is that there is, maybe a tendency to not see ourselves accurately, and also a big problem with denial. Now, denial, of course, is when we try to sustain and force a reality that isn't true. Takes a lot of energy. Does it mean that we're bad at thinking or feeling or doing in all areas? No, but it means that we're not able to be as open-hearted and honest and self-reflective as we need to be. Hey, I think that's part of the human condition, frankly, but I think it is more extreme in a family that is dealing with substance use disorder. It's a real thing. One of the symptoms of it is much like a silly example I'll give you. So we have three children. The first two were really good at math, and the third one was not good at math. And my husband is an IT guy. Pete is really good at math. I mean, just like extraordinarily good at math. There's some things he's not extraordinarily good at. Math is not one of them. So when our third child came along and he wasn't really good at math, This really bugged my husband, and he immediately began to try to be helpful. One of the things that he noticed is that my son did not retain anything he taught him. And he'd wake up in the morning and Pete, my husband, would say, "Hey, Michael, do you remember your seven times tables?" And Michael would go, "What do you mean by times tables? I'm exaggerating, but not by much." Michael couldn't retain math. He just couldn't. I'm sure there's some great neurochemical reasons for it, but he's never really been interested in it either. There's just that. But that's how denial is in our system. We'll grasp a point. We may even be able to articulate the point, but then we forget it. So it's really important for us to know this, not only as people who are in the system, but also people who are serving people in the system. We have to go slow and then go slower. We have to repeat and repeat and repeat. We have to keep trying to think of ways to learn and teach points that our brains are going to be resistant to hearing. It is the system that is resisting the change, which is not to be confused with the families being unteachable. The system is larger than the family. It has a lot of defense mechanisms to keep it up and running because the system believes that this is how it survives. This system is a response to the trauma of substance use disorder, but it colludes with the disease and does not embrace change. I've said before, and I'll say it again, we need to be patient with it. We need to take the long view, and we need to understand that small shifts are going to feel huge to the family, and we need to take that into consideration if we are part of the team that's coaching or supporting change. It's process, not perfection. It's systemic, so it's going to be really hard to apply in a lot of areas. And as I've said before, there's a lot of rigidity to the system, so there's a lot of resistance. So just showing up for a meeting, showing up late for a meeting, showing up 5 minutes before the meeting is over is sometimes a big win for folks. All right, so here, let me review for us some of the hallmarks of a compromised family system that we would be looking for. Very resistant to change. Very resilient. And I'm going to tell you a story about that. So the system itself is very adaptive for the purpose of sustaining itself. So here is my transparent slash oversharing story of the day. So as I've said, I grew up in an addictive family system. In an addictive family system, there are very unique roles that each family member plays. And these roles tend to be rigid, although the system can choose to decide to change the role. Understand that this isn't the family deciding to change the roles, and you don't get to pick your role. The system picks the role for you. I never really got this until it happened to me. So in my family system, I was the firstborn only daughter. I was the hero of the family. I always thought that I was the parent. It's not true, but that's what I thought. And there's some stories that made me think I was true because of the underfunctioning of my parental units. Last year, my mother was dying. She was at the end stage of Alzheimer's, and she was dying as a result of not getting very good care by my father. That's a bit of an understatement, but we won't go there. They live in a city different than me, and I'm about a 9.5-hour drive away from them. And at that same time, my daughter was very, very pregnant and about to give birth to my firstborn grandson. There was a family crisis as a result of my mother not being cared for well. I did what the hero always does. I dropped everything and rushed to be helpful. But my own treatment and care of my own therapeutic process, paired with the need that my daughter had for me. She was late, was going to be induced. And this commitment to being present for my child resulted in me saying no to my family system for the first time, probably in my whole life, in any substantive way. And after getting my mother settled in hospice and making sure she had 24-hour care, I got in the car and returned home. I moved within a 3-day period from 61 years of being the hero to being the scapegoat in the family. For a long time, I thought that my father did this to me. But what was really happening was the system will not sustain or tolerate a vacuum of the roles of the family. And my mother had often been the scapegoat, oddly enough, in terms of the dynamic of the family. The system was going to need a new one, somebody to make fun of and talk about and denigrate. And I was jumped to that role in warp speed. It was extremely discombobulating for me. It's really been hairy and bad. So I now understand, thanks to the beautiful work that Juanita Ryan has done with me, and listening to that class that you're going to listen to Dale teach in one of your sessions, one of his videos, that was the system doing its work, and it wasn't as personal as it still feels. As I said, this is multi-generational. It may be confusing to ferret it out, but it is. I want to make this point. It lies, cheats, and steals us as a family of our creativity, our problem-solving abilities, our commitment to love and respect for self and others. An addictive family system cannot hold the capacity to love, respect, problem solve, and be creative. Those two things cannot exist simultaneously. So very often what looks like love is not. And maybe back to Barbara's earlier question, we have whole families of people who don't really know what love means in terms of it being a verb. Although we may be taught that love means sacrificing for the system. Those are the hallmarks and the summary of those the big broad overview of the family system. Okay, because I think that's a review, I doubt that you have a ton of questions, so let me do this slide and then we'll go back to the questions. I wanted to tell you, sort of end our session with this idea of what is working. Because stuff is working. Treatment is working. The good and the bad news is that there's plenty of press coverage and political awareness of the epidemic of addiction at this point, substance use disorder. But the information isn't always accurate that's being given to the community. So that causes me both great joy and a little bit of angst. So we have to be careful, do good research, make sure we're learning and not repeating things that are half-truths or whole lies that we may be hearing from people, either from the pulpit or politically or in the news. We just need to dig deep. I'm going to try to do that for you. Community support works if the community is healthy. But remember, whether it's churches or recovery ministries, we tend to replicate the system that we come out of. So I want to give you some sort of key phrases that I hope will become sort of your mantra in terms of the care and treatment of substance use disorder. We should say to ourselves at least 100 times a day, I could be wrong, because we will be, and we are. We are learning so much about addiction, and the church in particular is very slow to adopt new ideas. So when it comes to doing interventions or treatment, medically assisted treatment, a lot of folks, whether they're in the 12-step rooms or whether they're in the church, have some prejudices against medically assisted treatment. And there's some folks who are touting medically assisted treatment as if it's the be-all and end-all. And what we know about recovery treatment is that there's a lot to throw at it, and we need to be willing to take a very 30,000-foot view of it and not be so stuck to the things that maybe work for us. We need to be able to say to ourselves, we miss stuff all the time. We miss cues and misread things, and we need to know that about ourselves. We need to know that for ourselves personally and for the people we work with, that we have unhealthy systems in place that no longer serve us well. Our defensiveness, our need to be right, our certainty about a particular way to do recovery ministry or do church or do recovery in a family. We need to realize that we're going to get attached to certain systems, and we too will resist change. And we need to remember that we're doing that and try to compensate for it, like taking classes and listening to people we disagree with and read books that we don't always agree with everything they write. We need to get help for ourselves. We need to have an accountability system in place. And we need to be not asking people to do things that they need to do that we aren't doing ourselves, which translated means we need to do them ourselves, because we definitely need to ask them to do it. We need to realize that we and others learn the language and the talk before we develop the capacity to consistently practice and do. We very often overestimate the wellness of someone when the only thing we're doing is listening to what they say and not creating a community that allows us to work and play and serve among one another, so that we can also see how we handle conflict and deal with relationships. We have to be careful within the church in particular to not promote a passionate person fairly new to recovery into a leadership position that they're not ready to have. There's nothing wrong with them. This is true for everybody. We should all go slow and go slower in terms of leadership. We need to develop non-judgmental attitudes that actually show up in our work. And I would say that we are unconsciously shaming, triggering, blaming, and manipulative at times, and that feeds the disease. So we need to be careful about that. Consistency works. Don't rush people through programs. Create environments where they can live and grow and learn. Take 3 steps forward and 17 steps back, and then get back on and serve again. Rapid re-entry after a relapse is awesome and important. Withdrawing from people, punishing them, blaming them for the fact that it takes a long time to learn is not helpful. Education works over and over and over again, and collaborative partnerships are the thing. We need to learn from people who have more experience than we do, have tools we haven't put on our belt yet, be extremely humble and teachable and ready to roll with all this awesome new stuff that research and long-term recovery ministries and treatment facilities and recovery therapists are teaching us.